Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, joined today by Chris Hutting. Let's get into it. The first news story of today is about Jacob Zuma's MK party, which has managed to successfully fend off an ANC attempt to have the party declared illegally registered. The ANC took the MK party to the electoral court, claiming that back when the MK party was registered successfully by the IEC, that correct procedures had not been followed, and therefore it should be delisted and not able to stand as a political party in the upcoming election. In a unanimous decision read by Judge Modiba, the court found the ANC failed to explain why it waited longer to initiate court proceedings, which is one of the problems here, is that the ANC took ages to actually challenge this decision. And it seems to me that they only are challenging this decision because they realized that the MK party is going to do a lot better than they expected. Chris, what do you make of this? Obviously, this was always, I think, a little bit of a Hail Mary. I think it would be very difficult to get the MK party thrown off the ballot. What do you think this says about the state of play between the ANC and MK parties?
I think with so many things over the last few years, the ANC wakes up a bit too late when there's a particular issue confronting them. If there was legitimate concern around this, or maybe some sort of strategy, then you would have expected something last year, November, December, to have already been put forward, not just in terms of the electoral court, but maybe other avenues as well around legitimacy of their candidates, any of that sort of stuff that you put in motion beforehand, where you aren't then scrambling and maybe not putting forward the best sorts of arguments where there isn't really legitimacy to what you're trying to do. So I think it exposes a bit once more how the ANC is consistently playing without that momentum. They're always reactive. Someone else, whether it be Zuma, whether it be someone else, the EFF, they set the momentum and then the ANC has to respond, which is interesting in of itself, how the ANC used to be the central force in the economy and society, and in some ways remains that, but it's becoming very different, that particular setup and the influence that it extends. It is still the biggest reactive force, but it is becoming more and more reactive over time. I think there might be other ways now that they try and counter MK, but I think they realize the particular challenge that MK poses to them in KZN, a province that is going to be very important for the party in the national and provincial elections. It always has been in the past, where former President Zuma did very well for the ANC, of course, to shore up their support in KZN. And I think in this order, MK is going to hurt the ANC, the IFP, and the EFF in KZN. So let's see just to what extent and what damage the party might cause to itself going forward now to try and downplay maybe the support that MK has, the influence that it has built up, taking over wholesale some ANC branches in KZN, as some reports indicate. Maybe trying to downplay it, but then at the same time scrambling to find a sort of silver bullet to try and end the threat. I think it's very interesting how this relationship is shaping up.
I also would like to just point out once again, I think I did on the show yesterday, but this was entirely a self-inflicted wound. The ANC had not dragged its feet if it had acted against Zuma much sooner, if it had not held up legal processes to take Zuma to prison, if it had not done all of these important things that have allowed Zuma essentially to escape consequences for some of the things he's done, not just to the country, but to the ANC itself. They may have been in a stronger position, and now they've, as you say, they've been caught flat-footed trying to try and catch up at the last second here to the MK party, as Zuma is way, way ahead of them, it seems, in his sort of strategic planning. This, I think this whole electoral court business confirms what has been leaked from the National Executive Committee of the ANC, which suggests that they never expected Zuma to start his own political party, perhaps suggesting that once again, Zuma's rivals have underestimated him. What this means for the larger country, I think, is a much different question as for what it means for the ANC. But this is obviously something to watch. We still don't know exactly how good the MK party is going to do in the upcoming election. Polling now has them somewhere around anywhere between sort of 13 and 5%. That's quite a big range. And we shall have to see whether that actually is borne out in reality. Okay, let us move on to our next story. And this is about the Johannesburg CBD and attempts to revitalize parts of it. So I've talked a lot on the show about how Johannesburg, at the moment, especially the past couple of years, has experienced some real service delivery declines. We've, of course, had the major water shortage in large parts of the city, well, pretty much ongoing since, I think, last year in various different parts of the city. Lots of creaking infrastructure, lots of unplanned power outages. There are, however, little sort of sparks of light, and they are almost entirely driven by the private sector. There's an article in the Daily Maverick talking about how private sector groups, private sector companies and NGOs have managed to essentially pay the government for the privilege of doing their job for them, essentially paying extra money to the city of Johannesburg in various areas of the CBD in order to be able to take over those districts, police the bylaws in them, and ensure that they become revitalized. One of the people behind this who talked to the Daily Maverick said that the perception of the CBD being a hellhole out of control is indeed real, and the situation is becoming worse in recent years. However, there are areas where people can walk about quite safely during the day or night without fear, being able to shop, bank, study, enjoy a meal. This guy was specifically involved in the redeveloping of Gandhi Square, which at the moment has been pretty successful. But essentially, in the private sector is having to carry a lot of the weight here. I think the one line in this story is, the key to the success has been public-private partnerships, but all the success is due to the private sector, which has done pretty much all the work. Essentially, all that's happened is the city has, in exchange for payouts, for rent, just allowed the private sector to go ahead and revitalize some of these areas. So I think there's quite a couple of interesting things about this. First, it shows that even something as deteriorated as the Joburg CBD can actually be in some places revitalized, and probably will be able to be if we had good governance. But also the kind of bizarro situation we're in, where the government, you know, in other countries might create a tax break for a company that's trying to revitalize a, you know, dysfunctional area. In this case, it's kind of the opposite. They're almost raising the tax on them unofficially. What do you make of this, Chris?
We should add, one of those offices or buildings benefiting from this near Gandhi Square are the offices of the EFF. And should they enter maybe national government in some sort of coalition, the policies they implement would make this sort of thing all the more difficult, if not impossible. And the value of their property would very much decline, if not be wiped out. So I think that's something just to keep in mind when you want that sort of investment in infrastructure, the sharing of skills, the building up of roads, buildings where people can either start new businesses or make sure that current ones continue to exist, that you can invest in those. You need the right sort of broad infrastructure in place. You only get that if you get investment, if you get capital. You don't get capital if you have the wrong macroeconomic policies, as has been the case over the last 10 years. We've seen South Africa's gross fixed capital formation declining. Decidedly, the National Development Plan sets a target of 30%, and we've never reached that. At some points, our highest was around 18-19%, but we've never reached 30%. So that's just a macro point to keep in mind. I think lots of credit to those involved here, the NGOs and the businesses, but I want to also put on them and others in the city of Joburg and also other metros, more rural areas, towns and cities that are looking at what was done here and how they could do it. What sort of concessions and requirements are they demanding from their local governments to come to the table, where it's not just a case of private citizens and businesses continually forking out just in terms of paying their taxes and their levies, but now having to pay on top of that to make sure that these sorts of things take off? What are you requiring from your local government that they come to the table, where it's not just the case of you always give and give and give, and that papers over the issues and the shortcomings that are put in place by your local government or indeed your national government? So it's not just trying to be a stopgap and covering up for them, but actually then demanding that they change what you think they need to in terms of bylaws, other policies and legislation that ensures that situation doesn't just persist ad nauseum, because you aren't going to always have that level of private capital and investment that you need to paper over the cracks. I think that's something important to keep in mind. It shouldn't just be done to quote unquote make things work for now, and then the underlying issues aren't resolved. I don't think that fixes the fundamentals.
Exactly. It's also I think important to recognize that this creates the sort of elitist space that the EFF and ANC are always terrified of creating, right? Because when businesses have to pay these extra costs on top of running themselves just to kind of keep an area all together and functioning, they're going to pass those prices where possible onto the consumer, which means that only wealthier people will be able to afford to use the services in that area, creating the exact kind of enclave that the ANC and EFF are always trying to denounce as being anti the spirit of South Africa. So if you wanted these places to be more open to more people and more inclusive, you should definitely give them tax breaks, because then they would be able to lower prices and have more customers from a wider range of economic backgrounds. Okay, let us go on to our very last story. And this is something you picked up, Chris, about South Africa's strategic oil reserves and a question asked in Parliament by the DA about it. What did you hear?
Yeah, so a question put to Minister Gwede Mantashe last month about South Africa's strategic oil reserves, how much we have in capacity, how close to the edge are we, if we are. In his response, the minister indicated that South Africa is currently at 7 million barrels of strategic oil reserves. That is down by 3 million from a year ago. So one needs to put that in context, maybe over 10 years or 20 years. Is that a sharp decline or not? But the trend line is downward. And in the context globally of ongoing conflict and tensions in the Middle East, shipping issues around Ethiopia, but also in the Panama Canal, obviously the Suez Canal impacted in the Middle East, you ask questions about global availability of crude oil. What that is, of course, used and refined for fuel that South Africa, that South African economy needs to for truckers to move around, given the decline of Transnet, you need to ensure that those fuel reserves are at full capacity, because so many businesses nowadays are forced to rely on trucking instead of on the railways. So here the question becomes, what are we doing to ensure contingencies? I don't think it's, you should presume that you'll always then have at least 6 or 7 million barrels worth. What are you doing to procure more? What are your backup plans? All that sort of thing. We know South Africa's refining capabilities have declined. There is now talk of trying to get new investment in things like Petro Gas in Mossel Bay and their facilities. Petro SA, is that actually going to happen? Where are you going to get the capital for that? There's talk of investing in partnerships with Gazprom from Russia. That's also subject to sanctions. All of these things raise the risk of higher energy costs in South Africa if we rely so much on imported fuel, if we can't rely on those that we've moved closer to geopolitically. Where do we get that from, those sorts of supplies from, and what do we do in that regard? As to risks of supply, when the minister was asked specifically on that point, how would the conflict in the Middle East maybe impact on the continued availability of crude oil imports, he said he doesn't really see it impacting at this point because oil and gas tankers haven't been targeted. And I mean, this was said a month ago, and they have been targeted, some of them, including tankers from Russia and China, which was interesting. They asked the Houthi rebels not to target their ships, but I think that has happened subsequently, maybe not on purpose, but by accident. So I don't think the minister should take it too lightly that this conflict couldn't increase further. I mean, if a country like Iran becomes directly involved, what does that mean for oil reserves, for global oil reserves?
Exactly. I think the minister there is vastly underplaying the potential downsides here. But anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope you found the show interesting. That's a wrap.